What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. This show is for you if you are not Catholic. Why would a Catholic network be doing a show for non-Catholics? Well, because we love our faith. We love the Lord. We love the Church. And you know what? We love you as well. And if you would like to know more about the Catholic faith, one of the best ways I can think of is to keep listening to Catholic radio, Catholic television, and, do your reading, do some due diligence, find out about what the Catholic faith is really all about. And a great resource for you is this program. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, give us a call, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside of North America, you can dial the U.S. country code, please, and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. We get texts all the time on a lot of our shows. We get them on Open Line. We get them on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie and Women of Grace and Morning Glory. We'd love texts. We'd love to answer your text. So just text the letters EWTN to 55000. All right. I think that's it. Oh, yeah. You can also write us an email if you prefer that, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Ryan Penny is our phone screener. Jeff Burson is on social media. He can pass on any questions that you may want to pose via YouTube or Facebook Live. We're streaming on both those platforms right now. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you?
Doing great. How are you, my friend?
You know, I'm hanging in there.
Got some very good news before we get to questions. We are very excited to welcome another new radio station, part of the EWTN family. Hi to everybody listening to us now on KKSJ. That's at 107.5 FM in Beloit, Kansas. Many thanks to Lynn Ellens and her great team for their hard work and prayers to get this new station on the air. Again, welcome to all of our new listeners now hearing us on 107.5 FM, KKSJ, Beloit, Kansas. Newest member of the EWTN radio family. How about that, David?
Fantastic.
It is exciting.
That makes me happy.
It makes me happy as well. We are going now to answer an email here as we're getting some of these phone calls screened. Here is a David in Irvine, California, who says, how do we reconcile infant baptism with the fact that we're not supposed to baptize someone against their will?
Thank you. Babies are not baptized against their will.
Okay. Next question.
I mean, quite. I mean, we're obviously not going to count their aversion to getting sprinkled with cold water. I mean, they are not consciously, rationally aware of the possibility of baptism and reasonably rejecting it, which would characterize the condition of an adult, for example.
If you
said, we're going to baptize you, and he said, no, I don't. I do not wish to be counted a Christian. That's not for me. I'm not doing that. I don't believe in God. No. That's not the situation of a baby. Baby is not exactly a tabula rasa, a blank slate, but full of potentiality. And the most important potentiality, of course, is the potentiality to become a child of God. And faith is not uninvolved in the question. First of all, the parents, godparents, profess faith on behalf of the child, and with baptism comes the gift of faith, comes sanctifying grace, of which the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity are its principal effects. And so faith is involved before, during, and after baptism on behalf of and within the heart of the child. And children have a natural disposition to believe what their parents tell them.
Sure.
Right. You know, I mean, it's a very good thing. I mean, imagine, you know, if you told your kid, don't jump off the cliff, and they said, well, you know, I'll see for myself whether jumping off the cliff is a good idea, right? You know, it wouldn't go so well for them.
No.
And so that gives them the opportunity, as they grow and develop and become reasonable and acquire the use of reason and so forth, that the habits of their will and mind and ideas and attitudes and aptitudes, the whole course of their development as human beings is under the domain of grace and in the bosom of the church, where they really have the potential to become the best versions of themselves. Why would you want to deprive your child of the opportunity to become the best version of himself or herself?
Absolutely. David, thank you so much for your email. Here's a question just came in from Ben via Facebook. A Protestant argued this way to deny faith and works. If a baptized man who has lived a horrendous life, evil by any objective moral standard, is on his deathbed, and mere minutes before he dies, he declares his faith in Jesus and asks for forgiveness, and then seconds later, does this wipe away his horrible, immortal, and evil life to go to heaven, even though he doesn't have time to do good works? If so, doesn't this dispel faith and works, since he hasn't done any good work except asking for forgiveness? Isn't it only his faith that has saved him?
Thank you. I appreciate the question. Your friend misunderstands how Catholics think that we are saved. All right? And he's contrasting faith and works, thinking of works as sort of like concrete historical actions that can be measured, photographed, so to speak, recorded in a newspaper or a journal, standing on a street corner and handing out a sandwich to a beggar. That's the kind of thing he has in mind by works.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not how the Catholic faith understands salvation. We don't think, Catholic Church does not teach, that, God has a ledger, and in the ledger he's sort of, quantitatively adding up the number of concrete good deeds that you did, and if you've done a sufficient number, you get into heaven. That's not the way it works. In fact, the Council of Trent, in the sixth session, chapter 16, says that simply in virtue of having grace, just in virtue of having grace, which we receive through faith in the sacraments. So like take a child who's just been baptized. The child, is as soon as the water falls off the kid's head, the child merits, we'll say that again, the child merits salvation, since the child has as a gift of grace the love of God. And that's what's necessary to be saved, that we love God and love neighbor. Now, if we keep on living, that's going to manifest itself in concrete acts like giving out the sandwich. But it's the love in our hearts that merits salvation.
Very good. Thank you for your question, Ben. Stay tuned for more Call to Communion. Glad to have you with us here on EWTN Radio's Call to Communion. I'm going to go to the phones in just a second. I want to take just a moment here to tell you about a friend of mine who is a certified goofball. Who am I talking about here? Dr. Ray Guarendi, of course. But you know what? He may be a wacky guy, but I almost said whack job. He's not a whack job.
I know what you're going
to. He's not a whack job. He is a very smart man.
I hope he's listening now.
I hope he is, too. Because if he was here, it would be even worse. Trust me, you will not be sorry, because Dr. Ray is going to answer every question you can imagine about family, about marriage, about relationships, how to handle that 15-year-old son or daughter in your family who's starting to say some strange things, and you're thinking, man, they didn't act like that 2 years ago. Well, there may be a reason for that. Check it out. It's The Doctor Is In tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. Yeah, whenever Ray comes to town, he and I and Adrienne will go to a nearby Chinese buffet, and we'll spend like 3 or 4 hours there, not eating, but just talking and, solving the problems of the world. It's a blast.
Oh, I love Ray. He's a magnificent character.
He's a good man. If you're ready now, let's get to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Let's go to Margaret in Atlanta, Georgia, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Margaret. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I have a question. I'm really kind of asking you for an affirmation. Our problem is we go to an abortion clinic and pray. There's a group of us, and we try to cover the 2 days at this abortion clinic where they do the chemical abortions.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm there, there's another group. We have people that try to cover the whole day, but there's this other Protestant group that's there at the same time that I'm there weekly. Mm-hmm. And they're very anti-Catholic. They attack us. And you being coming from a Protestant faith, maybe there's something you can tell us, some suggestions you can give us. I can tell you a little bit of what we've done. We did have to put up a sign between us that says we are two different groups, because this group is very hostile. They can be very, they are on a microphone. We just have signs and pray, but they are on a microphone. And they attack. They will try to start out being nice to the people as they get out of their cars. But if the people don't stop and come up and talk to them, then they can get very mean, evil, and start condemning them before they get into the door. Mm. We're not allowed to go up to them. We have to stand up on this hill, and they have to come up to us. So we only have like 10, 15 seconds before they get out of their car and go into the facility to try to get them. You know, we try to wave. We try to be friendly. But this group attacks us, and it kind of came, we've had confrontations with them before, not just myself, but other people. We've really tried to ignore them. But as I said, our leader put up a sign that said we are two different groups, because sometimes they just get into shouting matches with people in the parking lot, and we don't want them to think that we're part of them. Well, this other group takes a lot of offense at that. And last week, we had a person that came out of the clinic, and this couple had decided not to have an abortion. And so when they came to their car, they hollered at us, the microphone people, that's what we call them. They were shouting at them, and the gentleman said, "We're not doing it. We're not having the abortion." So we started clapping. And, you know, kind of, and then we were a little bit closer to their car than the other group was, so we offered for them to come up to us and get some brochures with some free help, you know, like the PRC clinic and that kind of thing. The moment the gentleman walked up to us and not to them, they started bashing the Catholic Church. You know, we just don't know what to do.
Okay. I have some experience with this, and I really appreciate the call. Thank you. So I have several things to say. I have a lot to say about this. First of all, Jesus talked about this. Jesus talked about this. He said, "Blessed are you when men revile you, when they reproach you, when they persecute you, and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake." So the first thing I have to say is, lucky you.
You're in good company.
Right? I mean, like, how many occasions have you had, or do you have on a regular basis, to get blessed in this way?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a blessing for you. It's not a very fun blessing, but I mean, it's a blessing, right?
Sure.
This is smack dab in the middle of the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. This is a major, major opportunity for you to merit reward in heaven and grace in this life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's the nature of God's grace that it's diffusive. You know, it doesn't just land on one person and stick there. One soul who is graced by God, in turn, is a light to and a means of grace, an instrument of reconciliation to the whole world. St. Paul says we are Christ's co-laborers, as if God were making his appeal through us. How did God make his appeal through Christ? Well, when Christ went like a lamb to the slaughter and did not open his mouth, when unjust and wicked men reviled him and reproached him and put him to death. That was precisely the way in which Christ brought salvation to the world. And it is precisely the way in which you have an opportunity to bring salvation to the world. So while, you know, you're thinking, these people are drowning us out. You know, they're putting us down. They're drowning us out. They're rendering our apostolate, our ministry, less effective because of their noise and their derision. And I say, on the contrary, perhaps God has placed them on that street corner as occasions of merit for you, so that, look, it's not just your persuasive argument that's going to win this battle. This is a spiritual battle. Our weapons are spiritual weapons. And grace and merit and salvation and the angels and the saints, the whole shooting match, all gets involved at ground zero here in these abortion facilities. And so perhaps God has put these people in your path precisely to save babies in an indirect way by allowing the Catholics on the street corner to acquire the merits and graces that will be effective for the salvation of babies in the supernatural order, if you follow what I'm saying.
Wow.
Like,
yeah.
You need grace to win this battle in the spiritual domain. People persecuting you for Christ's sake is like one of the principal ways of growing in grace and holiness and merit, which you can then pour out on behalf of the body of Christ, which includes these babies. St. Paul says, I fill up on my own flesh what's lacking in the suffering of Christ for the sake of his body, the church. Well, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
So go, Margaret.
Yeah.
And go, Catholics in Atlanta, Georgia, for putting up with this for the sake of Jesus. So that's the thing I have to say, number one.
Okay.
Secondly, not a few people have become Catholics by attacking them outside of abortion facilities. Not a few people have become Catholics by attacking Catholics outside of abortion facilities. One of my best friends in all the world, who I hope's listening to the show right now, who is actually the manager of one of our Guadalupe Radio Network affiliates here in Birmingham, Alabama, John Tidwell, never attacked Catholics outside of abortion facilities, but he spent a lot of time outside of abortion facilities. He's one of the most thoroughly pro-life people I know, from cradle to grave, from conception to grave, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And as he was kind of rubbing shoulders and elbows with all these people involved in this ministry and apostolate, he said, you know, the only people on the ground here who have the most thoroughly, completely pro-life ethic all the way through and who conduct themselves in the right manner are the Catholic folks. What have they got going on? And that eventually led him into the Catholic Church. A lot of other people have tracked that same thing. So you're saving babies. You may be saving Protestants, too.
Yeah.
All right. Now, why do they do this? Why do they do this? There are a number of reasons, but I want to point something out about the difference between the way Catholics and Protestants think about moral questions and abortion and all this kind of business. You know that when Roe v. Wade was made the law of the land in the United States, the people who were opposed to it were the Catholics. Protestant churches, by and large, were silent. Initially.
Mm-hmm.
Southern Baptist Convention, largest evangelical denomination in the country, applauded Roe v. Wade, if memory serves me correct, as upholding the principle of the separation of church and state.
Wow.
Hogwash. Hogwash. It's got nothing to do with the separation of church and state.
Of course.
But why would they make that argument? Because, and this is a gross generalization, but it holds in many cases, Protestants in general have no doctrine of natural law. They don't actually think that you can know the difference between right and wrong except by reading the Bible.
Mm.
So they don't really have rational arguments about morality, many of them, and often in a generality of cases. There are exceptions. But they don't really have rational arguments about what's right or wrong. All they can do is pound a Bible and say, God says, God says. And that's very off-putting. It's also not very rational,
yeah.
All right, because the guy on the other side of the fence doesn't believe the Bible. So why are you pounding the Bible? You have to appeal. You have to find some measure of common ground and appeal to our common humanity and our common reason to make these kinds of arguments. But when you don't believe in natural law and you don't believe in right reason, you're left to, you know, Bible pounding. And also, they don't really think that moral behavior has anything to do with the question of salvation. That's intrinsic to their doctrine of salvation, salvation by faith alone, not by anything to do with your moral behavior. And so it's more important within Protestant theological framework, oftentimes more important to coerce people than to persuade them. Because there's no appeal to reasons.
Right.
Right? There's just rhetoric. There's just sophistry and psychological manipulation. Because there are no sound reasons to believe in God or morality. There's just faith as the means of salvation and as access to, mm-hmm. you know, the rule book that they call the Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a very different way of thinking about religion, morality, human behavior that's embedded in the Protestant worldview. And does that mean that, like, they all yell on street corners? No. Of course, they can be very, very, very decent people. I mean,
sure.
My Protestant friends are outstanding. They're better folks than I am, right? My Baptist granddaddy was the best person I ever knew, right? But there's something about the worldview that can elicit this. That's why they need the witness of the Catholic faith. And you can save souls and you can save babies just by standing there. My daughter volunteers or has volunteered at a crisis pregnancy center where Tom Price actually on the board of that crisis pregnancy center. And she doesn't do anything there except like scrub the toilets and hang up the clothes. She's not a counselor. She doesn't do anything. Right. But she does a lot, but I mean, she doesn't get directly involved with the clients, you know. And a year or so ago, this woman contacted my wife out of the blue, thought that my wife was my daughter, got her phone number somehow, said, I just want you to know that you saved my baby. And we're like, huh? What's this? We don't know what this is coming from. Long story short, we get the story fixed. She said, you were nice to me. You were nice to me. That's all it took.
Sometimes
that's
all it takes.
That's all it took. Yeah. You were nice to me.
Wow. Margaret, thank you so much for your call. I must admit, you know, we hear a lot of questions on this program from time to time. I do hear something that I've never heard before, and I've never heard anything like this before. You would think that groups protesting outside of an abortion clinic would be united in that rather than picking on the other. I've just never run across that.
Well, you're
that.
Thinking like a Catholic right now.
Apparently so.
See, that's the Catholic way of thinking.
Okay. Guilty. Guilty as charged. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It is called to communion on EWTN. We do have a couple of lines open right now, so if you want to get in, here is your chance. Text just came in from David. Someone told me that our sacrifices are the most important part of the Mass. Can you tell me what our sacrifices are?
Absolutely. First of all, the sacrifice that all Catholics make when they go to the Mass is the sacrifice of the body and blood of Christ.
Okay.
So, see, the priest effects the sacrifice. We can't have the sacrifice without the priest. The priest has the power, in virtue of ordination, to confect the Eucharist, for transubstantiation to happen, for the bread and wine to become the body and blood of Christ. Can't do that without the priest. But it is not the priest only who offers the sacrifice. He effects the sacrifice, but the whole church offers it. And the Second Vatican Council was explicit on this for catechists. The faithful have to be taught that they offer the Immaculate Victim not only in the hands of the priest, but along with him. So our most important offering and sacrifice is the offering of the body and blood of Christ to God the Father. But along with that, we offer ourselves, our very lives. St. Paul says, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. This is your spiritual act of worship. So we, you know, the morning offering, Jesus, through the Immaculate Heart of Mary, I offer you my prayers, works, joys, sufferings, and sorrows. All right, along with the holy sacrifice of the Mass.
Mm, okay. And we thank you for your question. If you'd like to text us, just text the letters EWTN to 55000, and we will take it from there. In a moment, we'll get back to the phones, and I want to give you a personal shout-out here. If you've been thinking about calling this show, but you've been a little bit reluctant, perhaps, maybe you're thinking the lines are full. At the moment, they're not full. We have got an open line for you at this moment right now, 833-288-EWTN, if you have a question for Dr. David Anders. 833-288-3986. It is called Communion here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. Do stay with us. It's the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Sold out phones at the moment, but when a line becomes available, it's open for you at 833-288-EWTN. Let's go to Kevin now in Stamford, Connecticut, checking us out today on YouTube, a first-time caller. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Oh, Mr. Price, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. I love your program. Dr. Anders, love you too. And my question, Doctor, is this. I am trying to become a revert Catholic. Sadly, I've been away from the church for a while. Now, I know the first step I have to take, obviously, is, you know, the sacrament of confession. And I was, as I was telling Ryan, even my wife, who's a convert for the last 13 years, we found out that there seems to be, Dr. Anders, an inconsistency in the sacrament, the way it's administered. It seems like we're at the mercy of the personality of the confessor. Now, holy clergy, they perform all the other sacraments in the same manner, baptisms, mass, homilies can be a little different, but that's understandable. You know, things of that nature. But when it comes to confession, Dr. Anders, just three fast examples. Me personally, I have had some where I've left the confessional walking on air. I mean, I felt like $1 million. My confessor was so nice and loving. I've had others that were average, and I've had others that were nightmares. I was telling your screener, I had one priest one time stop me in the middle of my confession and say to me, sir, I don't feel like giving you absolution. And, you know, Dr. Anders, at the age of 62, I was stunned. I was like, I've never had this happen in all my life. So I said, Father, can I continue my confession? And he said, yeah. So I did, and then that was it. I had another priest use a four-letter word.
Okay.
All right. I think I can help, Kevin. I really do. I appreciate the question a lot. First of all, I'm very sorry to hear that you've had horrible experiences in confession. I have to confess, I've been Catholic since 2003. I don't think I've ever had a horrible experience in confession. I don't think I've ever had a horrible experience in confession. You know, and I remember one time one of my children was coming out actually here to EWTN for confession, and the child expressed to the priest some reservation about going to confession. And the priest said, I know this from the child, not from the priest, of course, said, why? Have we ever been mean to you? And the answer was so obviously no. So, I mean, I'm sorry to hear that that's happened to you. I really am. But here's what I would recommend. The Council of Trent taught that what is appropriate to matter to bring to the confessional is the kind and number of known mortal sins. That's it. That's all you got to say. So, you know, let's say you don't have to say, well, you know, on Monday, I knocked over the First National Bank and you know, held everybody up at gunpoint. And on Tuesday, you know, I held up the 7-Eleven and held everybody at gunpoint. And on Wednesday, you get the point. You don't have to do that. You just say theft 5 times.
That's it.
That's it. Kind and number. Theft 5 times. Let's say you've been knocking over banks and 7-Elevens for the last 20 years. Father, I've stolen a lot. I cannot remember how many times, but I'm really sorry. That's all you got to do. You don't have to go into the whole story, right? And in fact, it's best not to, because I don't see that. I mean, it's not relevant.
Right. It's
not. I mean, in my own life, sometimes you tell the story because you're embarrassed and you're trying to qualify and rationalize. And you're like, well, I knocked over the bank, but, you know, I was really hard up for cash. You know, you're trying to tell a story to make it sound not so bad. But honestly, my experience has been, The more detail you give, the more you feel the need to qualify the circumstances and try to mitigate the embarrassment factor.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just say, you know, theft 5 times,
yeah.
You know, that, I mean, that's just a fact, period, vanilla. And then there's not, and I'm sorry. And as long as you express contrition, the priest is obligated to absolve you. I have heard, I mean, these are almost like urban legends. You know, they're so rare. I mean, yeah. I have heard of priests who have denied absolution because they think that somebody is not contrite. I'm going to tell you one true story that I know about a priest who did this. And it was an American religious who was actually in Rome. And he was in the Vatican, St. Peter's. And he was hearing confessions from tourists and those who needed an English language confessor who lived there in Vatican City or in Rome. And a friend of mine who was a priest in Rome at the time told me that his secretary came in, she was all a mess. He said, "What's wrong?" She said, "That priest just denied me absolution." And he went, "Well, that's weird." And then about a week later, another secretary worked in the same office comes in all a mess and, "What's wrong?" "Well, that priest denied me absolution." And he goes, "Ah, I see a pattern. I'm going to go to confession." So my priest friend goes to confession. Guess what? He gets denied absolution. He says, "Uh-uh, this ain't right." All right. He went straight to whoever is, you know, deputized at the Vatican to run that part of the St. Peter's. He tells the story. The guy was on a plane that day out of Rome. Bye-bye. They got rid of him so fast it wouldn't even make your head spin.
Wow.
You know, he was just a nut. He was just a nut. That's all. You get nuts. But, you know, if you don't go into too much detail, in my experience, you're not going to have a problem.
You should be good. And, Kevin, don't let that sacrament of confession slow you down. Get, as my wife likes to say, get your soul in the box.
Yep.
You'll be good to go. We do appreciate your call. That is going to open up a line for you right now, 833-288-EWTN. It's called a communion in progress here on this Wednesday afternoon. Susie is listening in Houston on Guadalupe Radio. Hey, Susie, what's on your mind today?
Hello, yes. I have a question, and I'm not quite sure how to form it. Maybe you can help me. I have a relative, close relative in my family who was born Catholic and raised Catholic. However, he quit going to church at an early age. I don't know exactly what age, but an early age. And after he got married, at some point, I'm assuming he had joined he joined the church that his wife belonged to, which is the Church of Christ. And I want to try to understand how I can have a good relationship with this relative and yet not get into any kind of an argument. I don't want to get into an argument about religion.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that the Church of Christ, as a religion, they hate Catholics. Is that true?
Well, let me ask you a question. Is this relative of yours a very argumentative person? When you get around the fellow, does he have a habit of kind of prodding you and provoking you about your Catholicism?
Not at all. In fact, he overall, not even with relationship to religion, but in all areas, he's a very quiet person. He doesn't talk very much.
Then I would imagine you're not going to have a problem, right? I wouldn't worry that he's going to suddenly have a fundamental personality shift just because he's joined the Church of Christ. Now, there are many Church of Christ people who believe very strongly that Catholics are in error and they have bad thoughts about Catholicism. That doesn't mean that they are unpleasant with individual Catholics at all. I mean, there are unpleasant people everywhere. And if you're unpleasant, you're going to find a reason to be unpleasant. And if religion serves that purpose, fine. But look, you know, how you cooked the pot roast might count. That's enough reason to be you understand what I'm saying. An unpleasant person is going to be unpleasant under any circumstances. In my experience, even those who think the Catholic Church is way off base are not necessarily going to treat you badly because of that. They just think you're wrong. That's all. So if he's been friendly and nice to you thus far, I wouldn't anticipate any problem. And if you don't want to go there with him, you don't want to bring up the discussion, just don't bring it up.
Yeah, there you go. Susie, thank you so much for your call. It is called a communion here on EWTN. And here's a question now from Nancy. This came in not too long ago. I've heard you on your radio show tell a caller about how quick and easy they can obtain an annulment because of their extreme circumstances. As a case advocate for a diocese, I can assure you there are no quick annulments. Right now in my diocese, you're looking at a 1.5 to 2 year wait, even if it is a, quote, slam dunk annulment. Every case is thoroughly and completely gone over by canon lawyers and must take its place in line. Yes, sometimes it's obvious that the annulment is going to be granted, but that doesn't change the extreme wait that the petitioner has to undergo. Thought you should know about
that. Yeah, you're correct, and I fast and loose with the vocabulary sometimes. Sorry. I have a friend who is actually a judicial vicar and a canonist in another diocese, and he's it. Hadn't got but one.
Oh, man.
And so, you know, he's got a stack of paper on his desk a mile high, and he's, you know, it's like, how do you eat an elephant?
Start with the top
one. You know, one bite at a time. You know, he just has to go through the stack of paper in the order in which he receives it. And so your point is very well taken, and I understand that, and I apologize if I've led anybody to think that, you know, they're going to get an annulment in a week. What you can get in a week,
yes,
right, very often, is let's say you've dealt with, there aren't any impediments to having a marriage convalidated. Let's say you're in an invalid marriage because of lack of canonical form, for example, and all you got to do is have a marriage convalidated by restating your marriage vows in front of a priest. That was my case, right? That was quick and easy. I mean, that was just, hey, Father, can we get together on Thursday?
Yeah.
You know, but to actually have a declaration of nullity for a previous marriage, yeah, even one that's a slam dunk argument does have to get from the top of the stack to, or from the bottom of the stack to the top of the stack.
Okay, and that's where we got to leave that. Nancy, thank you so much for pointing that out. It is called Communion here on EWTN. Interesting question here from Thomas. He says, I'm a bit confused. In the book of Timothy, it talks about Christ being our hope, yet there is a prayer about Mary where we mention Mary as our hope. Hail, Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, or, you know, and on and on. I struggle with that prayer because Christ is our ultimate hope for salvation. Please help me understand all this.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So the word hope is used analogously here, not in the exact same way. And we hope all the time in things that are not our ultimate end or the cause of our ultimate end. So, you know, for example, I might hope to get a raise at work. You know, if I work for the bishop and he typically gives a cost of living adjustment, you know, at the end of every year, and that's kind of indexed a little bit to inflation, and I may be looking at the consumer price index and seeing it's gone up by X amount, you know, the change of the financial calendar is coming up, and I'm thinking, I'm hoping I have some confident basis here for about a, you know, 2% bump coming up. That's pretty nice, you know. I'm not hoping in the CPI for my eternal salvation, you know, but it's there's a sense in which there's a legitimate, rational, warranted hope or expectation of some future benefit. Now, in the when it comes to the disposition of grace and eternal life, so think about the Philippian jailer who in Acts chapter 16, and he sees a miracle and he says, what do I do to be saved? Or Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, angel says, send to Peter. I mean, send for Peter. And so Cornelius does. He sends for Peter. Peter shows up, and Cornelius says, all right, angel showed up here, said, I got to send for you. You're going to tell me how to be saved. What's up, buddy? All right. Both of these characters hoped that these human instruments, Paul and Peter, would give them something that would move them on the path to eternal life. All right? It was a legitimate hope. It was a warranted hope, an expectation that God is going to give me something through these people. Not ultimate salvation.
Yeah.
But the means to ultimate salvation, the truth and grace that I need to get there. That's what the saints do. Abraham, Genesis 18. God, will you wipe out everybody if I can find 10 righteous people? If you can find 10 righteous people. God says, I won't. I'll spare them all. If there are 10 righteous people, I'll spare them all. All right? So that reliance on instruments is multifaceted in the spiritual domain. It's not just, you know, distributing information, but can be distributing graces as well. Paul says, I fill up in my own flesh what's lacking in the promises of Christ for the sake of his body, the church. Like, even the suffering of a Christian can avail for the salvation of another.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so in that sense, the saints are participants in, Paul says, we were Christ's co-laborers, right? The saints are participants in the distribution of God's mercies in ways that warrant us saying, I hope in what God will distribute to me through the ministry of the saints, through the prayers of the saints, through the works of the saints. That's how grace comes to us, through instruments. So it's perfectly legitimate for me to say, I hope that I will be saved through the prayers and intercessions of the Blessed Virgin Mary. It's not Mary who's saving me.
Right.
But I can say legitimately, rationally, I hope that God will save me through the prayers of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Is Mary praying for me? You bet.
Yeah.
What, absolutely. Do I want those prayers to work or not work?
You'd probably
I hope they work.
You better believe it.
I hope her prayers work on my behalf.
Thomas, thank you so much for your email. It's called a communion here on EWTN. We'll get back to the phones in just a second here. Read an interesting statistic, probably about a week ago, that gave this huge number of United States households with a smart speaker, at least one smart speaker, whether it's the Google smart speaker or the Apple smart speaker or the Alexa, which a lot of people are very familiar with. And it's a big number. It's something like 30% of all U.S. households or 25%. Anyway, if you've got one of those in your home, maybe in your kitchen or in your bedroom, here's something you may not have ever tried. Try this. Just go like this. Alexa, ask EWTN to play Call to Communion. Boom, it'll start playing. Or what about this one? Alexa, ask EWTN to listen to the previous episode of Call to Communion. Maybe you want to hear yesterday's show. It's going to start playing. You might want to try this one. Alexa, play EWTN Radio Classics. It'll play our other channel, which is 24-hour teachings and devotionals. It's one more reason why EWTN is everywhere. And we're very glad to be on these great mobile platforms. All right, let's get back to the phones now and talk with Rosemary in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. She's a first-time caller. Rosemary, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for the shout-out. I've been thinking about calling, and thank you for what you guys do for the Catholic Church. I have a question about transgenderism. My nephew, a 12-year-old nephew, has recently asked my family to call him a girl, and he's asked to go by a girl's name. He asked me, and I didn't respond, as I wish I'd have. And I've thought about it and thought about saying how I love and accept him but can't partake, but would love some pointers.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I'm going to give you some thoughts, and I'm going to give you some resources. The resource that I'm going to direct you to is a statement that was recently published by the Vatican from the Holy See to give direction on precisely this question. And it's a document from the Sacred Congregation for Catholic Education, because it's really guiding Catholic educators.
Mm-hmm.
Male and female, he created them, is the title of the document. And a subtitle about how to handle gender theory and so forth. Male and female, he created from the Vatican Congregation for Sacred Congregation for Catholic Education. So that's the resource. I highly recommend that you take a look at that, read it, and think about it. You're also going to get some help from the Catholic apostolate known as Courage, right? Courage is a ministry especially to those that have same-sex attraction, mm-hmm. but also deals with these kinds of issues with transgenderism, gives pastoral support and counsel and so forth. They have a number of good resources as well. So those are two places for you to go for further information. Now, in terms of how would I approach this, I think if I were talking to a 12-year-old boy who said, I am a girl, the question obviously, you don't want to overwhelm the kid. You don't want to crush him. I mean, he's
right.
A very wounded person.
Sure.
Right? I would open a conversation and listen. Let the child talk. Let the child express. And in a way that is not going to come across as judgmental or I'm here to prove you wrong and I'm putting you down. But like genuine exploratory conversation, letting the meaning of this child's experiences be unfolded to you in an unthreatening kind of way, the question I would want to get at is, what does that mean? Can you tell me what you mean by the sentence, I am a girl? What is a girl? What is a girl? Now, this is me talking now. I cannot imagine that sentence means anything other than the following. Could mean a couple of things to the person who utters it.
Mm-hmm.
It might mean I have female biology. I have the right arrangement of chromosomes, and I have, the right plumbing.
Yeah.
That's what it usually means if someone says, I am a girl. Right? They're making a statement about biology. Well, that's not what holds in this case. All right? It might mean I would like to have a girl's name. That doesn't seem like a very robust claim. All right? I knew a girl one time named Douglas.
Really?
Yes. She had a boy's name, as I understand it, right?
All right.
There was nothing masculine about this woman.
Okay.
All right? Let me just tell you. Long hair, the whole bit.
Got it.
So that doesn't seem like a very robust claim. Doesn't say very much. Okay, well, we could call you a girl's name. Is that what it means to be a girl, that you have a girl's name? Well, I'd like to put on high heels and makeup and swing my hips. Oh, so being a girl means it behaving in stereotypically female ways. Is that what it means to be a girl? Well, I don't think any transgendered activist or ideologue wants to make that claim. That certainly runs flat against the spirit of modern feminism that denies that, you know, cultural stereotypes should be normative. So if it doesn't mean your biology, and it doesn't mean something as superficial as the kind of clothes you wear or the name you bear, what does it mean? Well, I really think there's only one coherent answer to that question left. What's left is, I wish I were a girl. I wish I were a girl. That's what this boils down to. I wish I were a girl. I wish I were a girl so that I could be treated like a girl. Because it seems to me that girls have it better in this respect or that respect. That's what this means. I wish I were a girl. And all you want to do at that point is take the child in your arms and say, oh, I love you. Oh, I love you. You don't need to be anything other than who you are to be good, to be loved, to be intimate, and to be valuable. Someone has rejected you. Someone's have rejected you. That someone might be yourself. Someone has rejected you as you are. And you think, if only I were someone or something else, I would be loved and I would be valuable. That's where we really have to do the work here. And changing my name and changing my clothes and cutting off body parts and taking injections, none of those things are going to get at the root problem, which is that I don't like myself and I wish I were someone different. And the science bears this out. I'm talking about the psychiatry. The outcome for those who have fully transitioned in sex reassignment surgery is this. Are you happy with your surgery? Yeah, I'm happy. Are you happy? No. Are you happy with the surgery? Yeah, I got what I was looking for. But are you happy? No.
We hear it time and again.
And the you know, you might explore the website Sex Change Regret for some testimonies about what happens psychologically in the life of people who actually go through with this, right? All the various comorbidities of depression and inclination to suicide, all these kinds of measurements of human psychological flourishing, they go down after sex reassignment surgery.
Yeah.
They don't improve.
Yeah.
Because what's at root is not solved by that approach.
Rosemary, we will be praying for you and for your nephew. Thank you so much for your call. Real quick question here from John in Buffalo, New York, listening on the station The Cross. John, we've only got a few seconds. What's on your mind?
Hi. How are you guys doing? I really appreciate your show. But I just wanted to comment and make 2 points. The answer that Dr. David gave that poor woman at the abortion clinic was just extraordinary and exquisite, to the point where I think it's probably going to change the way I feel about interacting with Protestants and people who denigrate our beliefs. And so I just want to let you know that. And also, I wish that I had two personal friends, meaning you both, that I could call up any time of the day and vet to, because that's how much you guys mean to me.
You've got us. We're here. You can call us.
Anytime.
But we're mostly here between 2 and 3 Eastern
that's
time,
right.
Monday through Friday.
That's right. Great call. John, thank you so much for your kind words. And this is why we do what we do. Am I right, David?
I love it, Tom.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's a great responsibility, and we're glad to bring you this program Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern with an encore at 11 p.m. Eastern. We also give you the best show of the week on Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, you can check out the podcast anytime at EWTNradio.net. On behalf of Charles, Ryan, and Jeff, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. We hope that you have a wonderful day. We'll see you tomorrow right here on EWTN Radio's Call to Communion. God bless.